Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. The mayor of Carbondale is resigning because she is moving to Redstone. Her move brings up the question of whether the once sleepy town of Carbondale is becoming unaffordable.
This is an interesting example of what's happening with these two elected officials who can't stay within the city limits in Carbondale. Those two voices might be lost.
And it looks like the politics involved in the race for the district attorney in the 9th Judicial District is bringing to light some meaty issues for the community to contemplate. It appears the fecal matter has disappeared from the City of Aspen's stormwater system. How and when that information was disseminated is up for debate.
And lo and behold, a release comes out at 6 p.m. Wednesday. Maybe they just thought, well, we got it. Let's put it out there since it is regarding public health.
When it comes to the public and media having access to open records in Colorado, it's an uphill battle.
Colorado's open records laws are really weak.
Finally, we remember two longtime Aspenites known for their big hearts and their contributions to the community.
They for sure may have been the smartest couple to ever live in Aspen.
Joining me this week are Roger Merolt, columnist for the Aspen Times, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, and Jill Bethard, editor of the Snowmass Sun. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be back.
Nice
Happy
to be
to
here.
Be here.
Randy, you got some things going on down there with the DA's office and the sheriff's department, but also there was some news that was in Thursday's Glenwood Post-Independent about the mayor of Carbondale stepping down.
It was a surprise. She announced it at the end of the meeting on Wednesday, and Stacey Burnett has been in Carbondale city government, a dozen years now. She's a fifth-generation Carbondalian, obviously really dedicated to the town. I mean, she's a Roaring Fork High grad, and her kids are going to school there. I had interviewed her a couple of weeks ago, following up a little bit on the Carbondale election results and just my sense of a creeping elitism in Carbondale. I mean, it's a well-meaning, you know, the people for the carbon tax want good things in the world and aren't out of step with the kind of quirky, mostly liberal, somewhat libertarian politics of Carbondale. But I think that their life experience enables them to look the other way and not consider the families that are struggling to stay in homes when property taxes go up 50-60%.
Is that the issue with Stacey?
She hasn't said explicitly. You know, when we talked, she said that longtime residents like her were becoming an endangered species, and that she doubted that her children would be able to live in Carbondale if they wanted to, which I think is a pretty stunning, you know, because of affordability, which I think is kind of a stunning thing. And she did say that the families moving to Redstone because of a housing opportunity that they couldn't pass up. So I don't want to try to speculate beyond that. I think people can read between the lines every bit as well as I can there. You know, when I talked with her, she had some of those same concerns about how does Carbondale hang on to its authenticity and how does it respect the ethnic, economic, and age diversity of the community. And I think her moving and then Katrina Byers, the town trustee who is homeless and who may have to give up her seat if she moves too, I think that it really does highlight the question of what is Carbondale going to become? Is it going to become another enclave dominated by the wealthy where kind of one family at a time, the less well-heeled move out and everything becomes a little bit more polished and a little bit more exclusive? Or is it going to be able to maintain this quirky authenticity? And, you know, Stacey talks about Carbondale's heritage being tolerant rednecks. The coal miners and the ranchers who, as the hippies moved in, kind of shrugged and accepted it. And I look at it as those folks, as the immigrants who are around us all the time, us white people all the time, who many of us kind of barely see. And then I call them hippies who do stuff. You know, the entrepreneurial free spirits who come in and start a business, start a nonprofit. And I think that's a really neat mix, and I do feel like it's jeopardized, and maybe there's not that much you can do about it, but we talk about housing all the time, and Carbondale is blessed by actually having some land where it could develop some creative housing options.
Well, you think about that, and I can certainly sympathize with her sentiments down there. I don't know if my kids will be able to live here either.
That would stop how many generations?
Five generations, just like Stacy.
She's the fifth.
So it's a daunting task. You just look at what's happened in Aspen, and it's not like Aspen didn't recognize the problem early on, and it's not like we haven't tried. We've put forth a pretty good effort here, and it seems to be slowing things down towards the inevitable at best. So I don't know if the people of Carbondale have learned anything from Aspen. I'd love to know what it is if they have, but it's a big road.
There are lots of housing ideas out there, from tiny houses to co-housing to, different things with a little bit higher density, making it easier to have an auxiliary dwelling unit. But it takes some political will, and it takes a real desire to keep the town that way.
Well, it's more than housing, too, because you start building more housing, and then all of a sudden you have to create more jobs for the people who are living there and the new people coming in, and it seems like it just spirals. It just, growth is growth, whether it's employee housing or any other kind of free market retail or industry. We've tried to build more employee housing in Aspen, and it just hasn't worked.
I don't know that growth has to. I mean, we live in a place where the real estate is naturally very valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's possible to have growth without making the whole town exclusive, but it has to be very intentional.
Yeah, and then it just speaks to everything about the quality of the workforce that you can get. And so if you can grow with businesses, you can get the talent in here, but they can't live anywhere, then how does that reflect on our resort community, from the front lines all the way to your people who are trying to run the town, run the show, your professionals?
Well, and our answer has been to push it down valley. People are commuting up and down.
Right. And now that's becoming.
Yeah, that's the normal. That's
right. Well, now that's becoming full as well.
Yeah.
It's hopeless.
Well, and this is an interesting example of what's happening with these two elected officials who can't stay within the city limits in Carbondale. I mean, now those two voices might be lost, and those are people representing the people who are in this problem.
Well, and if you're going to look at any bright side to it, it was a pretty dramatic statement, being elected and then saying you can't afford to stay there to fulfill your office duty. So at least people are aware of it now. It's a real problem.
Randy, you've also been covering an issue with the DA's office and the sheriff's department. And, of course, it is an election year, so this kind of stuff is going to come up. You had reported on a rift between Lou Valerio, the Garfield County Sheriff, and District Attorney Sherry Kaloya, and some more, information has come to light on that.
Yeah, we've done some additional reporting, as have some of the other media in the Valley has done some good stories on it. The DA's office wanted to get phone records in the Carbondale murder case that is to come to trial, I believe, toward the end of May. And they wanted the defendant jail phone records. And there were emails back and forth that included questions about how much the sheriff's office would charge the DA for it. And Sherry at some point was copied and jumped in and said, look, we won't pay for it, which led Lou to send this real blast at her, calling her incompetent and calling her a child or saying she was acting like a child. I mean, it's clearly partisan politics. Lou is a plugged-in, active Republican who's for Jefferson Cheney, who is running against Sherry, and Sherry's an incumbent Democrat who doesn't necessarily do law enforcement's bidding. But I think the good that has come out of it is that it brings the real issues here, which are questions of the DA working with law enforcement and what the DA's office appropriate role is. The DA, of course, wants a case to be brought to them as solidly and airtight as possible, and the judges here want the DA to sign off on arrest warrants, so the law enforcement will take their case to an assistant DA. It may escalate to Sherry in some cases. And often the DA's office is asking for more. And then the other issue, and this is a perennial issue in prosecuting attorneys' races and offices, is she's plea bargaining a lot. They feel like she's letting people back onto the street who are dangerous. And, you know, law enforcement never likes that. And you can always find good anecdotes of, see, this guy was out on the street and shouldn't have been on the street. It's a tough balancing act. You know, most criminal cases in the United States are settled by plea bargain. A whole lot of charges are dropped. A whole lot of charges are reduced. And the way that you manage the caseload and the resources of your office is to make a judgment about what you're going to try to take to trial and what cases are not winners for you, so you plead them down or just dismiss them. Some law officers side with Valerio. Gene Schilling in Carbondale said the communication with Colloy has been really good. So there's a historic and rather natural tension between the prosecutor and the DA, and there's this partisan divide. And I guess that it's an opportunity for voters to better understand the issues there and then make their choice.
Sherry was quoted extensively in a lot of these articles. She said, look, this is the checks and balances, the natural role of the relationship between prosecutors and law enforcement. We're supposed to be putting them through their paces. As far as pleading stuff out that shouldn't have been, you know, that's kind of a more serious accusation. I wonder, has that actually happened where someone who pleaded out was back on the street and then reoffended?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are people out on bond, and it's not around here so far, as best I can tell, it's not the high profile, you know, this guy was charged with attempted murder and pleaded down to disorderly conduct and then went out and beat somebody else up.
It's not like violent crimes, but
it's more the drug people are back onto the street.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And, you know, some guy's busted for drugs, he gets a plea deal, then he goes out and steals a car, threatens somebody with a gun, and has an accident. If I'm a cop, then I'm upset about that.
Sure. Well, it's just crime triage, though. We don't have enough prison space to put all the people who deserve to be in jail, so somebody's got to go free.
And, you know, there are only so many people in the DA's office, so it is a tough situation.
Curtis, didn't the Daily News report on do a story about that this is a rift that goes back 20 years ago from some murder case?
Well, there was a murder case. There's a guy who is accused of killing his wife back in the 90s, but they didn't find any evidence. They eventually found a skull turned up way out in western Garfield County, and they were able to put a case together against this guy for killing his wife. You know, at that point, it was 5 years or more ago. He was in Britain, and they went all the way over there. This is what it dates back to. A lot of this disagreement was they go all the way over there, they extradite the guy, they bring him back, they had a case against him, and then it was pleaded down to second-degree murder. And they, you know, the investigator was of the opinion that it should have been first-degree trial capital case.
Well, there you go. That's an example.
Yeah. And I think that illustrates it pretty clearly what you were talking about. Like, you have to decide what, you know, what's your best bet here.
And this kind of all came about, too, because of some phone records that...
That just strikes me as a little crazy, right, that we're arguing about that?
Right,
how
it all started.
That we're bickering kind of about dollars and cents between the agencies?
Right.
But then, doesn't it seem like it's more than that? I mean, like, in our weekly publication, the Aspen Times Weekly, John Colson's made a comment in his column this week about... He was opining on people trumping each other. He's using the word Trump as a verb now. slandering or calling someone a name or playing dirty with discussions that should happen in a different kind of way. And he believes that that's what this is between Valerio and Kaloya. Whether or not that's your take on it, I think it's more than a checks and balances. It seems like a philosophical difference and a very politicized conversation.
You should always think twice before sending the email that says you're acting like a 3-year-old, right?
You should. Take heed.
It never sounds as good in real life as it does when you're looking at it.
Well, then that leads me to the email I sent on Wednesday night that I probably should have waited to send to the communications specialist for the city of Aspen. So here's an issue that I'm going to set up here. The city realizes that there is fecal matter going into the stormwater system. And the Aspen Times reports on this and can't really get a straight answer from the city about why this is happening, why the smell is going on. Lots of phone calls are being made. And out of the blue, all the media outlets get a press release at 6 o'clock some evening, no heads up at all, saying there's,
cease and desist order was issued to a major high-end luxury property at the base of Aspen Mountain.
When you send a press release out at 6 o'clock, newsrooms have already set their budgets. Reporters are wrapping up what they're doing, or they still have a full plate because of the day's news, and it doesn't serve the public well when something like that goes out, because we can't make follow-up phone calls, so you have an underreported story and maybe even inaccurate information that can't get confirmed, and you certainly can't get the other side. And this just happened again on Wednesday night. Press release went out from the city of Aspen at 5 p.m. saying, oh, the state says it's okay now for your dogs to go into the wetlands because everything's cleaned up. There's no heads up. And again, underreported, unconfirmed information that we all had to deal with. The Times, I think it was buried inside somewhere in the Daily News.
Yeah, and I mean, in that situation, you pretty much just say, well, okay, and you do a little news item based on their press release.
Right.
I mean,
which is what they want.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, a look at the week's news with writers and editors in the Valley. We continue our conversation on how the city of Aspen provided information to the public and media about the stormwater system being contaminated. Joining me are Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Roger Merle, columnist for the Aspen Times, Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, and Jill Bethard, editor of the Sonoma Sun. It serves the public to let the media organizations know that this is coming, so we can do a full report on it. This is a public health issue, right? So why not?
Well, they're working for us. They should let us know what's going on.
And you can check their facts and talk to the other side and talk to the Nell and, yeah.
You know, when it's the city, that's our government. They're supposed to be working for us. They're supposed to be on our side. They're supposed to keep us informed.
And the media is the public.
Yeah, well, that's the arm that they can use to keep us informed.
Don't you think that, I'm guessing what happened was, as you had heard earlier, they weren't expecting to get this information regarding the cleanliness of our water supply until Thursday. And lo and behold, a release comes out at 6 p.m. Wednesday. Maybe they just thought, well, we got it. Let's put it out there since it is regarding public health.
That's a good point. And this dovetails into an editorial that you wrote, Randy, about open records, which is completely separate but related, in how difficult it can be sometimes to get public records.
You know, Colorado's open records laws are really weak. There was an effort in the legislature this year to many, many state agencies keep information in databases, but the Colorado law right now does not require information to be given to people from a public records request in the form that it's kept. So I got, just for example, the Colorado Lottery has a page of winners where you can work really hard and sort through and and find winners by location for a limited period of time. I did an open records request to try to get a more complete record of that, and they sent PDFs, which can't be sorted, which can't be, you know, you can't do analysis and lump things together to tell people either fun information or needed information. And the Department of Revenue, which runs the lottery and which, in my experience, is really hostile to open records, said, you know, we won't give you the database. We're not required to. There are some fields in that that are private. So, and, you know, we're not going to do that. So they would rather create a PDF and spend government workers' time hand redacting that information, which is a ridiculous waste of time. And then, of course, they charge the organization or the individual seeking the open records by the hour for doing that. The item that I wrote the editorial about just shows, I think, the silliness of some provisions of the open records law. We had a diesel leak that was discovered in the bridge construction here, and it was near where there used to be a lot of gas stations. The last of those was the Shell station that CDOT purchased for the bridge project. So I had a note that, you know, at some point we're going to find out how much CDOT paid for all the properties it acquired. Since there was a diesel leak, I asked about the Shell station, and CDOT said, well, you know, we don't release that until the project is complete,
right?
Which isn't actually the case. They explained a little bit more later that they don't consider it a public record, and they have a legal opinion that backs them up on this, until all of the property that they're going to buy for a particular project is purchased, because they think that it would harm negotiations for those organizations that, you know, haven't completed the sale yet, that they're going to find out how much CDOT paid the neighbor, and that puts CDOT at a disadvantage. The fact is, I went to the Garfield County Courthouse, and with the help of a savvy clerk and recorder's office employee, was able to find the sale price. So it is, in fact, a public record. It's a public record in Garfield County, but the state of Colorado says they can't release it, and that's just silly.
Yeah, you know, it's not just related limited to Colorado. I remember when I was at the Daily News and the FBI was investigating the sheriff's office, and I wanted to know how much money the DEA and the FBI had spent on investigating some wild goose chase, and they totally shut me down. It took me 6 months to even get an answer from the federal government, which was, we can't release anything because it's still under investigation. When is it going to be not under investigation? We don't know. So we never got that information. It was, you know, nothing ever came of it. It's very frustrating.
Well, and it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It just doesn't serve the public good. They don't know what their government's doing. There's no transparency with all these public monies in a lot of cases.
I think it's gotten worse than it's ever been.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more, Caroline.
Moving on to the unfortunate news of a couple longtime locals passing away, and this, I think, is just going to become regular news, unfortunately, in our community, as the people who really shaped community of Aspen start to leave us. So we had Taga Peterson and Maggie DeWolf pass away this week. Both were Aspen Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
Roger, you, I'm sure, knew both of them fairly well.
Yeah, I knew Taga more than Maggie, but Taga was way ahead of the curve as far as what he did in this town. You know, he was a trainer and a physical therapist and, you know, sort of a doctor and an athlete all at the same time. And he put a lot of people together and helped them keep doing what they do in the active lifestyle around here. And he set the bar high for those who would follow him and helping us out and recover and train and
for the ski team.
Like that. He did an awful lot for the ski team, but he did you know, all kinds of local athletes and high school athletes, and so he was a great guy, and he'll be missed a lot.
Yeah, he did stuff before physical therapy was even a term.
Yeah, it was like a big experiment for him. He didn't have a book to go off of. He was just figuring it out as he went, and he was very smart, and he understood the human anatomy, and he did amazing things with people.
And Maggie DeWolf, mm-hmm. the Daily News, did a nice obituary piece on her for Thursday's paper, and we did something too on the air Thursday morning. And it's like, for every great man, there's a great woman, right? Mm-hmm. And so yeah. Nick DeWolf, he was famous in his own right here. Mm-hmm. And his wife, Maggie, I think she propped him up.
That's certainly what it sounds like, and complimented all his, eccentricities. And just, it sounded like it was a really good example of, the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, and how they worked together and complemented each other.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she always had, an awesome garden, and she wrote nice letters to the editor.
I mean, her letters are great. So yeah. I spent over an hour reading all through our archive, just going back to, 2008, 2009. So only a small slice of some of her letters to the editor, and very philosophical and very much. I mean, they came here. He was, he was like a prodigy who graduated MIT at age 19 and went on to start a very successful early computer testing business, and kind of had made it for himself as a fairly young guy, and decided to bring the whole family out west. Always wanted to live out west, and they picked Aspen, at the time in kind of the early to mid 70s, and they just felt like, man, this is it. This really hits all the right notes of a funky place where both high and low. I kept hearing that a lot from the family. They were really into the high and the low. You'd walk through their house, which there's not like an inch of open wall space. It's covered with photos and artifacts and everything from, all over the world. And, one of her daughters was saying, like, you could have this really, beautiful, very valuable thing next to like this like cheap plastic thing they thought was funny that they found in like, South Dakota.
Their house is cool too. I remember growing up, it was like something you'd see in a Disney movie, because it was this Victorian house with a giant telescope. There was a big dome on top that opened up, and a big telescope shot out of there. So
cool. It's awesome. They were very eccentric, cool. and Nick was the one who created the water fountain.
The water fountain, which apparently, and this was a revolutionary thing in the time, whether or not you can actually have quote-unquote random, randomized things. But they designed it where the sequence of the water jets going, it's like you'll never see the same sequence twice.
I never have.
Apparently you'd have to watch it for 70,000 years to see the same 20-minute sequence, wow. According to a gentleman who helped Nick design
and
it.
And I'm chalking that up to Maggie's.
Her cooking.
And I met with Steve Skadron, the mayor of Aspen, on Thursday morning, and he said, I remember Nick DeWolf, after about 3 years I was here, he looked at me and he said, you can stay.
Well, they for sure may have been the smartest couple to ever live in Aspen.
Right? Absolutely.
Sounds like it.
All right, on that note, thanks for coming in, and Randy, giving your insight down there at the Glenwood Post-Independent.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thanks for having us in.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Valley Roundup. Thanks to Jill Beathard, editor of the Snowmass Sun, Roger Merle, columnist for the Aspen Times, Randy Essex, editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, and Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.